listening to The Realist Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in over the years. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to The Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage all listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications if you are not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce my special guest today. It is my honor to have Paul Neelan on The Realist Report today. Mr. Neelan is currently running for Congress in Wisconsin against Paul Ryan, the GOP incumbent congressman. Mr. Neelan, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, John.
Thank you so much for coming on. I contacted you actually a few weeks ago, maybe close to a month ago, and I've been following your campaign very closely, going back to when you first ran in 2016, and I was following you on Twitter and following your campaign website, and I know you've basically been kicked off of Twitter from what I understand. I've been very impressed with your campaign, especially the campaign you're currently running. So I'm curious, because I actually reached out to you and then you followed up with me just recently. So I'm curious, how did you hear about my website, or were you just responding to my original email?
Yeah, no, I somehow came across something that you had worked on, and we actually have a mutual contact, and I said, you know, I had to reach out to him, and that contact said, yeah, you probably ought to. I bet he'd have you on. And I don't know what happened to the email that you sent to me. It must have got by me, so I apologize for that, but was glad that we were able to connect. And I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, me too. Again, I've been following you very closely, and I've been very impressed. I think you're doing, really at this point, I think you're doing God's work bringing up some of the issues that you are in a very bold and courageous way. So I guess just to get started, could you maybe just give our listeners a little bit of background, talk about your professional career, your business experience, and then we'll kind of go from there?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a Midwestern guy. I grew up in Ohio, moved to the East Coast, didn't have the money to go to college. So I worked my way through college. I started out in a factory with a wrench and a torch in my hand and eventually ran that factory and ran factories all around the globe. I've been part of Fortune 200, Fortune 500, private equity companies. I've got a slew of U.S. patents for my inventions, and it just so happens that I am living in the district where Paul Ryan happens to reside, and I found out that he was pushing this Trans-Pacific Partnership article based on a letter that Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama wrote describing this terrible trade deal, and I just could not believe it. And so that act of Jeff Sessions writing that letter is what motivated me to step into the arena and put a stop to that trade deal. I've had nearly 20,000 employees in my lifetime, and I was going to be damned if I was going to stand by and watch Paul Ryan burn it down. So
nice. Okay, very good. And this was back in 2016 when...
Yes, sir. That was 2016.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. So I'm curious, your professional experience, you talk about how you're working in a factory and you ended up managing a number of factories. What kind of factories were they? Like industrial production or manufacturing?
Yeah, the manufacturing businesses. I sat out in a business. It was probably $70 million annual sales, building compressed air purification equipment, industrial equipment. And then I went on to companies building valves, pumps, heat exchangers, homogenizers, all sorts of food and beverage equipment, power and energy equipment, for transformers that transmit electricity into your house and into other factories. I was in charge of Europe, the Middle East, and Africa for a Fortune 500. I've had businesses in Asia. I've, in fact, closed two Mexican facilities with two different companies and brought those jobs back to the United States. And I closed a Canadian factory and relocated their sales and engineering offices back in 2013. Those jobs came back to the United States. So it is possible to bring work back to the United States. It's easy to ship jobs off to China. I mean, any knucklehead can do that. But, it takes some strategy and perseverance and determination to bring jobs back to the United States. So that's kind of been my claim to fame, I guess you would say.
That's very cool. That's very interesting. I admire you and admire your career and everything that you've done. Sounds like you're a very successful businessman, manager. Were you a? I was reading your resume. You were a general manager as well of like an entire facility. Is that correct?
Yeah, in like a fortune setting, the president a division or a company, you might have 10 or 15 general managers running a multitude of businesses. Like when I was general manager of the process equipment business out of Wisconsin, I had Buffalo, New York, Chicago, Wisconsin, Mexico City, and Modesto, California. But then when I was in Europe, I had over 20 factories, over 10 engineering centers, supply chain businesses, just all spread out all over the place. So whether you're a vice president or a senior vice president or a general manager, it really depends on kind of the stratification within the fortune setting. So,
gotcha. Very, very interesting. Well, I'm curious. You've had a very successful, business career and professional career. I have kind of a sort of a broad question. What does it take to be successful in America today? Because it seems like a lot of people struggle to find a good job. A decent paying job, something that they actually, they wake up and they want to go do. A lot of people work in America, but are they really doing something that they feel, productive, they feel proactive, and they feel, is it rewarding, is it fulfilling? And I think that's something that we've kind of lost. I wouldn't say it's totally out the window, but a lot of people, it seems like, struggle to find meaningful work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is, a lot of our manufacturing, we build a lot of things in the United States. We still build a lot of things, and we're certainly the biggest market, which is why everybody wants to sell here. And so I think a lot of people who might not otherwise go into manufacturing, first because there isn't as much manufacturing as there once was in this country. But as it comes back, as Trump leverages tariffs and factories will relocate to the United States to get around tariffs, that is a reality. And we will have more manufacturing jobs here. I cannot tell you how much joy I have going into a manufacturing facility and seeing things transformed into useful objects and going out to customers. God bless me with the ability to work in manufacturing environments and diagnose and troubleshoot and improve them. And I just love the camaraderie of manufacturing, you know, being around engineers and production planning people and shipping people. It's really a good group camaraderie that I'm sure it's not for everybody. I'm sure it's not for everybody that they, but the key is that we all have these opportunities, that we don't outsource them to foreign countries or even more insidiously, decide that we're going to bring H-1B and H-2B workers into this country or have open borders, unsecured borders, where illegals can come in and take these jobs away. Because, you know, when they report the unemployment numbers, they are excluding the people who've just given up, the people who, you know, we've made it so easy for people to get onto permanent disability that they just say, you know, F it. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep going and looking for a job and coming home empty-handed. I'm going to find some way to claim that I'm disabled. And, you know, that just breaks my heart when I see that happen. And there's a lot of people that are on the fringes who are, you know, getting themselves into trouble. This opioid epidemic we have in this country. And just, I mean, there's so many things that need to be fixed. And it starts with having productive work. A lot of it starts with having productive work. People get self-worth out of that job. People get, you know, the ability to change their destiny based on that work that they can do. And, you know, so I think you should take every opportunity for every training you can get, because you never know when later on, nobody can ever take your knowledge away from you. You know, I mean, you can fall off your motorcycle and bust your head open, but generally speaking, you know, read a lot of books, watch a lot of instructional things, fill your head with good, useful things, and don't waste it away on crappy television.
Yes, very well said. I completely agree with you. That's sort of my outlook when it comes to work, is I'm always trying to be productive. I always want to work hard, you know, get as much done each day as possible, and really just learn every day and take every day as a new challenge, a new opportunity to grow and to get better at what you do, whatever it is that, you know, you're doing. I've had some employment issues given, you know, my publicly expressed political views. So I don't really want to talk about what I do for a living. But I can say that it is in an industry similar to what you describe, you know, your sort of background in. And it is very, very, I go to work and I feel fulfilled. I feel like I'm actually accomplishing something. I'm doing real work. I'm not sitting behind a desk and scamming people, for example. You know, there's a lot of jobs nowadays where, you know, you're doing telemarketing or you're recruiting people or you're selling them junk that they don't need. So there's a lot of sort of like parasitic type employment opportunities that people, frankly, a lot of times they don't have any other option. And I think not having real meaningful work has a very profound psychological and emotional impact on people, especially men. I think that men, young men in particular, we need something productive to do. Otherwise, all hell is going to break loose. People are going to start doing drugs or doing any number of other very unproductive things. So I think it's something that's very important, and it sounds like you've kind of had a career doing this, and you know what it takes to be successful. And it sounds like even more particularly, you've seen firsthand how our trade policies, how our other more broader economic policies have impacted our economy. And again, you kind of explained, you know, this was your decision to jump into politics and run against Paul Ryan in 2016 was because he was out there promoting open borders and globalism and these free trade deals that have been absolutely disastrous to the United States economy and to the American worker. So just to kind of recap, that was, again, your primary reason for getting involved was seeing what Paul Ryan was up to, and seeing him, you know, promote the, what was it, the TPP, I remember that when it was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was kind of what led you to get into politics. That was the primary thing, but I know you've also kind of branched out, and now you're talking about other issues, immigration, as you sort of explained. Would you say that was really the main thing, was trying to restore America's economy, essentially?
Yeah, that was absolutely the main thing. I would have run on that issue alone to stop that trade deal. It was that bad. It would have turned the United States of America into the United States of Asia. And, but you know, I worked hard with the Remembrance Project, the group that supports families that have lost someone to illegal alien violence. And, you know, I've met a lot of those moms and dads and brothers and sisters, Kate Steinle's mom and dad, and Spencer Golvach's mom and dad. And the list just goes on and on. Danny Oliver and Brandon Mendoza, Josh Wilkerson's mom, all those people who have lost somebody, they are real people. They are American citizens who, through no fault of their own, encountered an illegal alien who had no business being in this country in the first place, and they lost a loved one. And I am hell-bent on seeing a fence or a wall put up on that border that's going to be defended, that any man, woman, or child that approaches that fence is treated like an enemy combatant, and we defend that border. I've had it with this unaccompanied children BS and the open borders crowd not for us to defend our border. Well, it sure is okay for Israel to defend their border, isn't it? They eject the ethnically impure and defend their border. And I've had it. I've absolutely had it. So
yes, as have millions of other Americans.
Yeah.
And see, this is what's so insane, is that you just start making these, you know, very basic common sense points. You know, look, we can't have illegal aliens in our country. Certainly we can't have them here committing crimes and killing people. We can't have all of these migrants come over here and take all our jobs. You know, these, you mentioned the H-1B visas, I think they're called, and
yeah,
there's a number of other, you know, visa programs that these large corporations primarily utilize to get to get labor in and pay them oftentimes a lesser amount than what they would pay an American worker. So it's just been absolutely disastrous making these common sense points, you know, putting America first, putting our economy first, putting our workers first. Is now we live in such a politically correct age where this is considered racist. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, I was just having a conversation with some friends, some neighbor friends, and, you know, we don't really talk politics all that much, but it came out that I supported Trump. And I was like, well, you know, I don't want to get into all the details, but my main thing was Trump's stand on immigration. I think we should build a wall. I think these illegals got to go. You know, I don't care how nice they are. I mean, they could be the nicest people in the world. They could be even productive workers. That's irrelevant. That's beside the point. We have laws in this country that need to be enforced, and they're not being enforced. Why are we giving social services and welfare and other benefits to people that are not even supposed to be here? To criminals. Bottom line, these people are criminals, and they got to go. And to me, that's so just matter-of-fact and so straightforward and so just, look, this is the law. It's a law and order issue. It's not a racial issue. I mean, I could make a racial argument for a lot of these things, but really, at the end of the day, that is the basic argument, is, look, we have laws in this country, and they need to be enforced, and they're not being enforced. And we have a government, you know, basically that's controlled by a very hostile elite that is hell-bent on dispossessing the very people who founded this country. And that is wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree. What race makes it okay for you to go into somebody else's country and break their There's no race card that you can play that makes that all right. And furthermore, we keep hearing this argument that, well, you know, illegals don't commit more crimes at a higher rate than citizens. There should be that is a false argument from the jump. There should be zero crimes committed by illegals in this country because there should be zero illegals in this country. To suggest that the rate of crime has anything to do with it is false. There shouldn't be any illegals in this country. Whether you came here illegally or you overstayed your visa, it doesn't matter. If you're on our soil illegally, you're illegal. You get sent out. The problem exists that we have no means to keep people out of this country. The guy who killed Spencer Golvach, he had been deported four times. He had previously spent time in American prisons. He shot Spencer in the head at a red light. Spencer just pulled up, and the guy used his head as target practice. Kate Steinle was murdered by a five-time previously deported illegal alien. We can't keep these people out of this country. We're giving them a free trip back to Mexico, but that's not doing us any good. It doesn't do us any good at all. We've got to have a way to keep them out of this country. So
now, and that's sort of where the wall comes in, correct? And I think the wall would be effective at, you know, preventing people from just, yeah, you know, crossing our border at will. But also, I think it's sort of like a symbolic thing as well. Like, look, the United States is not, you know, just up for exploitation any longer. We are enforcing our laws. We're building a wall, and we're getting serious about this. I mean, think about it. What other country, aside from the United States, maybe Canada, certainly Europe, you know, what other countries out there, and by the way, all of those countries just so happen to be founded and built by white people. Mm-hmm. You know, what other country out there, you mentioned Israel, you use Israel as an example, that's a very ethnocentric, you know, racial state. You have to be Jewish to be a citizen. You can't just show up in Israel and expect to get welfare and housing and, you know, free schooling and everything else. Don't you ever go over to China expecting that? I mean, give me a break. Every other country enforces their laws for a reason. Why is it only the United States and European countries and maybe to a lesser extent Canada? I don't know. I don't know all the details of what's going on in Canada, but it seems like it's only Western countries that are pitched as these proposition nations where everyone from anywhere in the world has a right to come over here and become an American citizen, and not even necessarily become an American citizen, but just to come over here and exploit our resources and take advantage of everything that we've built up. You know what I mean? It's absolutely outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, more people are becoming aware of the situation. And I think a big part of the fact that I'm not on Twitter anymore was a big part of the fact that I was spending a whole lot of time pointing out the amazing hypocrisy of censorship on the internet. And, you know, my shall not censor proposal, which would make it a federal crime for the large social media companies, essentially YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, free speech would carry on to, or lawful speech would carry on to those social media platforms. And I don't think it's a coincidence that a few days after I introduced that proposal, that the onslaught of attacks from the globalists, and I named them, was just off the hook. Just completely
relentless. I remember watching it play out on Twitter.
Yeah. So, you know, I had, you know, and I, in December, I released that proposal December 14th, and I immediately started getting attacked for being an anti-Semite and a racist. And I by then, I had been really noticing who it was that was attacking me. And so I decided to count up all the just the verified Twitter users, not even unverified, just the verified Twitter users in my feed who were attacking me. And I wrote down their name and their Twitter handle. And I set about researching those 81 people who attacked me in December of 2017. And it turned out that 74 of those folks were of one tribe, and 7 were of another tribe. And the 74 were from the Jewish tribe, which represents 2% of the United States. So I had a 92% by people who make up 2% of the U.S. population. Now, I'm an engineer, but it doesn't take an engineer or a statistician to tell that there is something absolutely sticking out at you when that happens. And so
don't you dare notice that, though, right? I mean, you can't notice these things.
I got a 7-day Twitter suspension for noticing it. And, you know, I was forced to delete my truthful tweets, which pointed out the hypocrisy of that. And, you know, I'm not ashamed of that. Every single day, John, every single day, blacks and whites and Hispanics and Han Chinese, they're all subjected to criticism and critique in all sorts of circumstances and situations. All races are subject to that criticism and critique, all except for one, Jews. That's a double standard, and that's unacceptable. And I am going to continue to point out the hypocrisy of this, because it is undermining and unweaving the fabric of our society. And, you know, I grew up Lutheran. I went to Catholic church with my ex-wife and her kid. I got married and immediately had kids in junior high. I was 29. I had kids in junior high. You know, I raised those boys like they were my own. I got them through junior high and high school and college and graduate school. And, we ended up splitting up, but I went on to, I ended up in an evangelical church, and at first, but there was a whole lot of reference to, kind of like reverence for Israel. And I really didn't understand it. I mean, at the time, I had no idea. You know, I mean, this was 2014. I didn't really, I mean, until really 2017, I kind of noticed it in 2016. And I really started noticing in 2017, and towards the end of 2017, it was unquestionable that the people that were attacking me were predominantly Jewish. And then things started making a whole lot more sense to me. Things that had gone on in 2016 made a lot more sense to me. And so, being that I'd lived 47 years and really didn't catch on to all this, I thought, you know, this is my responsibility to tell other people, hey, this is going on around us. And it's not about anything other than being pro-white. And I've been called white supremacist, a racist, an anti-Semite. And, you know, if pro-white is white supremacism, what is pro-Jewish? To me, it's Jewish supremacism. If pro-white is white supremacist, then pro-Jewish is Jewish supremacism. And certainly, if you look at it from the ADL's perspective, there is no such thing as Jewish supremacism. The Jewish supremacists will tell you. And whenever the news media decides that it is going to validate one of their stories, there will be a Jewish newspaper or news media story they will check with the ADL to see if what they're writing about me is true. That, you know, is Neilan really an anti-Semite? So a group of Jews goes to another group of Jews to validate what the first group of Jews says. Are you kidding me? I mean, it's constant. I had a guy write a story today in the Boston Herald that was filled with lies, He said the first time Neilan ran in 2012, he was a Tea Party candidate. I never ran in 2012. Then he went on to equate me with these folks who tipped over Jewish headstones and made graffiti, Nazi graffiti. Well, it turns out those were all perpetrated by Jews. All of those were hoaxes. They were all perpetrated by Jews. I mean, the article just went on and on. And a classic case of gaslighting. And we deal with that every day, but people aren't aware of it. And certainly evangelical Christians who think there's still some land grant, there's still some promise from God to these folks who spit on Christ. That land grant is not with those people. And I'm going to continue to tell the story. I'm going to continue to say to everybody, hey, look, what you're being taught in evangelical church stems from the Scofield Bible, and it's not the teachings of Martin Luther. It's not the teachings of the early Christian church. The early Christian church saw it for what it was. The Jews were expelled from Israel in AD 70 because God told them they were going to be expelled. And it's not God who brought Israel back. I'm convinced hasn't been better. I don't think the U.S. has been blessed more since Israel's been in existence. In fact, if you went back to when Israel, 1948, is the United States better now than it was in 1948? I would argue it isn't. I would argue we are more divisive. We've got this diversity, which is divisive, which is in every culture, when you try to jam a bunch of cultures together, you end up with catastrophe is what you end up with. And that's what we have here, is headed towards catastrophe. They are making it okay in the news media to suggest that it's okay to punch a Nazi. Well, guess what? The only people who can be called Nazis are white people. That's what they're doing. They're giving us a name and saying it's okay to punch white people. It's okay to dispossess white people. I just read an article in a 400 level seminary class in Indiana was thrown out of the class for challenging the professor that there's only two races. And the woman that was teaching the class had just had some TED talk from some transvestite or trans something or other. I mean, up is down. Down is up. And we've got to come together as a people and say, this is wrong, right? We're going to advocate for white people. That doesn't mean we're advocating against somebody else. We're advocating for white people. And I think it is absolutely, I'm reading an article right now by Greg, a book by Greg Johnson called New Right versus Greg, about meta-politics and all of us coming together because.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with the book. I've read it myself. I have a copy of it. Yeah, it's a very good book. Sorry, go ahead and finish up your thought. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. Yeah, I think that those, you know, we have to get smarter about what we're doing. We have to read up, and we can't vote as split blocks. We really can't, because the reality is there is a concerted effort right now to essentially do away with the white race. It's going on across the globe right now, and we've got to reverse it. We've yep. built some greatest civilizations known to man, and we have to make a concerted effort to save it.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And, you know, I'm curious because, of course, anytime you get into these topics, whether it's, you know, criticizing Jews or just simply noticing things about Jews and noticing the way Jews behave, the way Jews operate, the sort of agendas they push, the sort of narratives they push, just noticing these things and be, you know, becoming concerned about it, doing research into it, etc. It'll lead you down these paths to racial realism, to really, you know, kind of researching the Jewish question. So I'm curious, how would you describe your racial views? Because if I'm not mistaken, in 2016, you were more sort of like just an America First Trump style populist, right? You weren't really getting into the racial issues. You weren't really getting into, you know, the Jewish question, for example. So we've kind of seen a transformation and it seems relatively recent. So I'm just curious, like, how would you describe to somebody your overall racial views?
Well, you're right. You watched in real time. Everybody who said, oh yeah, hey, look at this meme of Paul Neelan in Israel in 2016 at the wall. Yeah, I was. I had my Trump hat on. I went to Israel and I did filming for a documentary that I did on Islam. And I had no idea anything going on behind Islam or there were other people pulling strings and other stuff going on. And everybody watched me in real time taking red pills and getting wise to the situation. And I would say at this point, I would describe myself as a race realist, that I acknowledge that there are differences between races and there are values, different values in different races and different, you know, I watched a video last night of a black preacher who's an American guy. And he was talking about, and the guy has traveled all over and he was really well educated, had his story together. And he said, you know, he'd been to St. Petersburg and he was talking about when St. Petersburg was built and how St. Peter went out and built this, glorious, glorious city where there was nothing before it and how, there were no white men in Africa in the 1400s or the 1500s or the 1600s. And that he had been over to Oxford. This black preacher had been over to Oxford and he was in these buildings that were built in, I think he said, like, I don't know, 1680 or 1714 or some very old. And he was just marveled at that. He said, you know, there isn't a single structure in all of Africa from Libya all the way to Cape Town. Not one. From the 1400s or the 1500s or the 1600s, not from the 1700s. There might be one from the 1800s. And, you know, he said, you can't blame white people for that. And the guy was dead on right. And so you look at that and you say, wait a minute, we've built civilizations and people aren't racing to other countries to establish themselves in these other countries. They're racing to white countries. They're racing to countries where white heritage built that country. And you'll hear people say, well, yeah, America was built on the back of blacks. No blacks built Boston. No blacks built many, many northern towns. And only 1.6% of the people in the South owned slaves. So yeah, there was slavery. And how did those slaves get here? The Muslims rounded them up and sold them off. And the blacks fought against the blacks in Africa and sold them to the Muslims. And who was doing all of the money keeping and the trading of that? It was the Jews. I mean, when you step back and you look at all this and you go, wow, there's a whole lot of race realism to learn if you're willing to be called a racist. If you're willing to stand in the breach and be called names, you can learn a whole lot. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't love my wife, who happens to be not white. I love her dearly. I prayed to God that he would send me somebody who loved me. That's all I wanted, was somebody who loved me. And, you know, my first wife was white. I married my high school sweetheart, and that didn't work out, and I married another woman who was white, and we were married for quite a while, and things didn't work out and you feel terrible. You know, God, I keep moving forward and, you know, I keep praying about things and, you know, God sent me a woman who loves me very much. She doesn't happen to be white. You heard her on the phone. You think she's the whitest woman you ever met, but, she loves me. She takes care of me. She looks out for me. She cares for me. But, you know, I say these things to her, you know, it's dangerous in Mexico. I mean, there, you know, largely there's a population down there that, is prone to violence and, does not value life the same way we do here in the United States. And, every day I'm proven right. There's amputations by drug dealers and murders and kidnappings and just the most horrific things right on the southern border of the United States, right over the border and bleeding in the United States. So, I am absolutely, a race realist. You know, if you ask 1,000 Chinese people that spoke English in China, you and I took time travel and went to China right now, and we're there for coffee in the morning, and we asked 1,000 Chinese people, what would happen if you stopped working? The predominant answer we would get from them is you die. But here in the United States, you can be a single mom with 8 children of 5 or 8 different fathers, and you could decide that you need some more money from the government, so you're going to have a 9th child. Now, if you or I say, well, that's wrong, you shouldn't be able to do that, we're either called racists or uncaring bigots or whatever, no matter what the color of that mom. And there's some sense of entitlement here in this country that's built up over time that it's wrong. That's wrong whether you're a white person or a black person or a brown person, any person. They have no right to my money. They have no right to John Friend's money in order to stay home and make babies and live off the largesse of the government. So I think within races there are stratification. There's the strong and the weak, the smart and the fool, you know, the hardworking and the lazy slackered. We have to be willing to call that out.
Yeah. You know, I think you're making a lot of good points. And, you know, one thing I think that a lot of people struggle with, especially white people, when it comes to some of these racial issues, is that our overall historical narrative is presented from such an anti-white perspective. I mean, white people, if you think about it, you know, like growing up in America, for example, as a white child, you know, you're learning about how evil white people came and took over America and had slaves and, you know, killed their slaves, whipped their slaves, treated them terribly, separated families apart. You know, we exploited the Native Americans and, you know, enslaved them. Then there's colonialism. And then, of course, the Holocaust that pretty much every single white person is apparently responsible for. So my point is that our historical narrative, the mainstream historical narrative, is presented from a very anti-white perspective. And I think that that prevents a lot of white people from having a healthy racial consciousness. I mean, you know, racial issues aren't really taught in school anyways, you know, like race realism anyways. So it's fundamentally presented from a very anti-white perspective where, you know, white people, and there's even quotes from, you know, some of these radical Jewish intellectuals, for example, where they're literally saying white people are the cancer of history. White people are responsible for, you know, all of the problems we see in the world today, all of the injustice we see in the world today. And, you know, so most people get this and they don't really think critically about it. They're not offered any other alternative explanation of history or whatever. And the more research that I did when I kind of started getting into some of these racial issues, I was reading Dr. Kevin McDonald's website, theoccidentalobserver.net, who's somebody who he recently joined your campaign, which I do want to talk about here in just a second. Right. But I started reading, you know, material from Dr. McDonald, Jared Taylor. You mentioned Greg Johnson. I've read a couple of his books and, you know, other thinkers and writers and whatnot. And I came to the realization that a more accurate and objective perspective of history portrays whites truly as the founders of civilization and really the people that really created all of the political development we see today, created all of the, at least most of it, the economic development, all of the advances in technology and architecture. I mean, you name it. I mean, really, I think that's a much more accurate, objective, and ultimately a much more healthy person, certainly for white people, but also for, you know, everybody else for that matter, a much better narrative of history, one that's actually true and not totally weaponized by Jews against whites. I mean, that's my opinion, but I think we can make a pretty good case that that is exactly what's going on. So I think really that's kind of a main impediment to people actually having a healthy racial perspective, at least, you know, white people anyways, is we are presented, our history is presented in such a negative and an anti-white way that it's difficult to think about these things. And of course, our perspectives, pro-white perspectives, race realist perspectives, are not even allowed to be entertained in schools. It's that tyrannical.
Yeah, I'm frequently annoyed when I hear this raging against Russia. Russia, we ought to be friends with Russia by this time. And I would suggest that if we were aligned with Russia and not with Israel, we would be in a lot better position as a globe than we are today, and that a lot of this fighting, you know, it's almost as if it's the man behind the curtain doing a lot of this. For example, the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite, right? That put in a lot of people's minds that, you know, it's terrible that there's so many white people, when in fact Hollywood is all Jews. And you know, if you look at somebody, the color of their skin doesn't tell you that they're white or if they're Jewish. And, you know, maybe the keen observer can tell one from the other. I can't. I have to research it. And I have to, you know, check out the names, check out the history, check out all the things that the markers that, as you will. So that whole shapeshifter situation where we're led to believe that whites are doing all these bad things, when in fact they're Jews that are doing these things, and they're portraying right. themselves as white when they do them for the benefit of undermining the whites. But an interesting thing is happening, and it comes from all places. The Nation of Islam. You may have seen some of the leader of the Nation of Islam recently, he has been naming the Jew. And so I, for a moment, thought, well, maybe I'll reach out to him and have a discussion. And I thought, well, maybe not. You know, he's a pretty polarizing figure. And there's probably folks who maybe have a larger drawing in the African American community. But the reality is, the African American community and the Hispanic community are being manipulated by the Jews the same way whites are being manipulated by the Jews. And I think, I don't know this to be true, but I think blacks think those folks are whites, and same thing with Hispanics. And they think it's whites doing this stuff to them, when in fact it's the Jews. And the better we are at pointing that out to them, the more folks we're going to have on our side. Because I don't think we should only wage this battle against the globalists, the international cosmopolitans, ourselves. I think we should enlist the help of the African American Americans and Hispanics. I want them to have their own space. I do. And I want my own space. I don't want to have to constantly be waging battle with the blacks and the Hispanics because they think the whites are the ones behind all the shenanigans when in fact it's the Jews that are behind all these shenanigans. So I'm going to make a concerted effort to point that out to them.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think you're making a lot of sense, and that's kind of always been my approach, is I'm willing to, you know, collaborate with, work with, or just have an honest conversation with anybody, you know, no matter their race, even if they're Jewish. You know, if you want to have a conversation about these issues, let's do it. But I expect you to hear me out, just like I'm going to hear you out. And, you know, I can't have you be offended at every little thing I say. But I think, again, I think a lot of, like, non-whites in general, I think they have been used by the organized Jewish community as sort of like the pawns in this greater game, right? I think that you can make a very strong case with that. And especially when it comes to, like, the history between the organized Jewish community and the black community. Like, the NAACP, for example, was founded by a bunch of Jews. You know, as a way to basically instigate them and to use them to ultimately undermine white society. And we see this across the board with the organized Jewish community. I mean, they are always partnering up and collaborating with every single minority, whether it's illegal aliens now or blacks back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Or, you know, right now the big thing is the LGBT community. You know, they use all of these minorities in this broader war against traditional Western Christian civilization, which, you know, I shouldn't have to point this out, but I will, was founded by white people and, you know, developed by white people primarily. So I think you're right about that. And I think there are, you know, you do see a lot more people on YouTube and in the alternative media, on Twitter, etc., that are, you know, not non-white, and they're talking about Jews. They recognize these things. I've been following, you were talking about the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan. I've been following him for a number of years, and he's always been a critic of Jews, and he's always stood up to them. He's always called out, you know, just exposed Jewish power, Jewish supremacy in the United States. And I do want to get into the Jewish question and how you got Dr. McDonald working on your campaign.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, it really, you started connecting the dots. It was primarily, and you kind of already explained this, primarily because of all the censorship and all the Jewish pressure put on you on Twitter and on other social media platforms to basically shut you down and to get you to shut up talking about, you know, the issues that you were at the time. Is that basically correct? Oh,
sorry, you broke up on me there.
Oh no, I was just to kind of recap, you know how you kind of got into looking more closely at sort of the Jewish question. It was primarily because these people were attempting to shut you down, correct? And well, then that kind of led into to other aspects. Go ahead.
Yeah, that you know, it started back in 2016. I had people attacking me on the trade deal and on closing the border down, and I noticed it a little bit back then, but it wasn't so cut and dried at that point. And then supporting Trump, I had some of the same people, but some more folks attacking me. And then when I made my documentary, Hijra, Radical Islam's Global Invasion, I had Christians attacking me there. And I went over to Israel, and there's a woman on Twitter named Amy Mech. Just before I left, I was talking to a guy by the name of Jared Wyand on Twitter, and she reached out to me in a DM conversation, was like, Jared Wyand is a rotten human being. He's a white supremacist and blah, blah, blah. And I chatted with Jared a few times, and I didn't find him offensive at all. And I basically told Amy that, well, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, but I'm going to choose who I speak to. I'm not, you know, you're not going to reach out to me and tell me who I'm allowed to talk to and who I'm not allowed to talk to. I mean, that's, who the hell does that, right? Well, turns out that's what Jews do.
That's what they do.
So,
yep.
I learned about, it was about a year ago, January, the story about 20 million Christians being killed by these Bolshevik Jews. And I had never heard this story before. And I said, where did this come from? Why am I just now hearing this? I'm 46 years old at the time. And the guy that I was speaking to said, you need to get this book, The Culture of Critique. He said, I can't explain this to you right now in one conversation. You'll never be like the most massive red pill ever. You aren't ready for this. So I got the book, and I, like that day, I got the book and I read 10 pages of it, and I shook my head and I laid the book down. I said, what the hell is this guy talking about? And that book laid there for like 6 months.
Last I heard was, you know, you were describing Culture Critique and how you obtained a copy of the book and you read like 10 pages and then you put it down and the book laid there for 6 months. You want to pick up right there?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So then the attacks just kept coming, and I did the best that I could with all of them, you know, kept on my message. And I picked that book up again, I don't know, 3-4 more months later, and read the same 10 pages and put it back down. And I just couldn't get it. And then I when the attacks came after I released the census legislation, and I realized all these attacks, 92% of these attacks in December were from Jews. I picked that book back up and started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. And then I reached out to, I've got a mutual friend with Dr. McDonald, and asked him if it'd be okay if I called. And I called him, and he said to me, I've been a big fan of yours. And I thought that was so funny because, you know, I just read his book and I really, really enjoyed it. I wanted to talk to him about it, and we had a great conversation, and he's very kind. Was time. He wants to help me learn and understand. And so I asked him if he would be interested in being on my campaign, and he very graciously, first he asked me, and we discussed how that would play out, and he said that he was interested in doing it, and I'm very grateful for that. I've got Josh Smith moved over to legislative director, and unlike most other campaigns in the country, we're writing legislation ahead of being elected because we want somebody to pick it up. This shall not censor legislation is so vital to free speech on the de facto public square, as the Supreme Court has ruled the social media platforms are now the de facto public square. And I've got a couple other things that are brewing that are going to be coming to fruition here very quickly behind it, because I don't look at being as a full-time the rest of my working days. I'm going to do that for you know, a few years, and then I'm going to step out of it and let somebody younger coming up behind me work on it. I'm an engineer. I like building things. I like running businesses. I think that I'll be good for a while helping with the nation, and I intend to do that. So I'm just very grateful that Dr. McDonald has agreed to help me.
Yes, me too. I read your press release, which I think you put out, if I'm not mistaken, last Friday. Mm-hmm. And I subscribed to your campaign. By the way, could you want to give out the website?
Sure. Yeah. It's electnealen.com. Elect NEHLEN.com.
Perfect. And I'll of course have a link over
me on Gab. Yeah.
Yep, I'll have a link.
Sorry?
Over. Yeah, no, I was going to say I'll have a link over to your official campaign website, right, as well as to your Gab profile, which is probably right, the best way to follow what you're doing. Unless you're on Facebook, I guess. I'm not on Facebook.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. I'm fairly active on Facebook. You know, the constituencies are different. I've got, probably an older population on Facebook here. And so I communicate with them, fairly regularly, a few times a day, in fact. And, I'm a voracious reader, and I try to share with people what I'm into at the moment and following and trying to keep them aware abreast of what's going on in Congress. In fact, there's going to be a vote this week on taking guns away from veterans. They're going to call it, they always call these things some ridiculous name, like Protecting Safe Schools Act or something like that. And it really is this NICS fix going through, and it's going to pay $500 million to a bunch of different U.S. agencies to add names to the NICS list. Well, do you think they're going to add more names or fewer names if they're given more money? They're going to add more names. They're going to add a bunch of veterans' names. If any veterans have anybody helping them take care of their money or any number of things, it's going to be a trigger for their rights, their Second Amendment to be abrogated. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. Yes, and this is something that they've been working on for a very, very long time, this whole gun grab issue. Yeah, no doubt. Well, I'm really glad that Dr. McDonald has agreed to join your campaign. I've always been very, very impressed with his work. His book, Culture Critique, was very, very influential on my thinking, as it sounds like it has been on yours. I think the issues that he addresses in that book and the other issues that he addresses on his website are just so important, so critical to the future of our country, to the future of our nation, to the future of our race and of our world. I mean, they're that important. They go to the heart of what's going on, of what's wrong in the world. And I think it's absolutely essential that we start talking about these things publicly and do so, you know, in a political way, in a political campaign. Somebody's got to stand up and say these things. And mm-hmm. I'm so glad that you are. And there's others that are starting to do the same. I think, you know, Trump has really kind of emboldened the alt-right and allowed, more room for our ideas to gain more traction and certainly to get more coverage. I mean, we see how the media has been hysterically covering the alt-right and some of these other, you know, the issues that are important to the alt-right. I have a question. We have to wrap up here in just a second. I'd love to do this again, though, and maybe get into sure. more details of your campaign and you know, what exactly you're proposing and things like that. But I think this was a pretty good sort of introductory type conversation. I wanted to ask you, though, before we wrap up, would you consider yourself like part of the alt-right or like an alt-right political candidate? How would you address that question if like a mainstream reporter were to ask you, for example?
Sure. The problem with saying, am I alt-right is they want to say, oh, alt-right equals white national, white supremacist. And so I don't have a problem with somebody calling me an alt-right candidate. I really don't. I don't go around labeling myself. I mean, I label myself as a Christian and I label myself as white and pro-white. But as soon as you get off of that into some type of lingo that people aren't really aware of, I probably need to have an elevator speech that says, yeah, I'm fine with being called alt-right if this is your definition of alt-right, and get 15-second rendition of what that means. I guess to distill it to its essence, to me, is it's a pro-white candidate. And so, yes, all day, every day, I will admit to being a pro-white candidate. So,
well, very good. It's about time we had at least one pro-white candidate out there representing our interests and bringing up some of these topics. I think that's very good. And yeah. I'm very encouraged. I mean, really, like, the way things are going politically, I think things are definitely moving in our direction. Maybe not as quickly as some of us would like, but these things do take time. And I think your campaign and the issues that you're raising, the topics that you're bringing up are so, so vital, so important. And I think you're doing a great job representing them and championing them and explaining them to people. And I certainly wish you the best of luck in the campaign. And again, I'd really like to do this again and kind of get into more details of sure. what it is exactly you're proposing. I think we could do a whole podcast just kind of focusing on that, because we really didn't get a chance to get into, you know, all your all the issues that are important to your campaign. I mean, we talked about them kind of broadly, but I think it'd be good to talk about them in some more detail. So, Paul,
great.
Well,
that sounds great.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much. I'm really glad that you reached out. I'm glad that we finally connected, and we'll have to stay in touch and definitely do this again, man.
Okay, great. Keep up the great work with your website and your writing and your podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate that as well. I will definitely be in touch, and I will send you a link to this podcast once it's up on the website.
And I'll put it up. Thanks, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. I will talk to you real soon.
Okay, God bless.
Okay.